Thank you, everyone. Welcome to the session Beyond the Benchmark, Perspectives on Adding Value to the Investment Process. This is going to be a panel discussion. I have my three panellists here. The first, Michael O'Neill, is an equities manager with Investors Mutual, specialising in insurance, information technology and media sectors, covering large and small cap companies. Michael also sits on the council of the Institute. Next, I have Jeff Warren. He's a senior lecturer at ANU, focusing in on asset pricing, valuations, portfolio construction and funds management. Jeff has previously worked as Director of Capital Markets Research at Russell. Then I have Andrew Francis, who's CEO of Real Index Investing. Andrew has more than 15 years of investment experience in consulting, funds management and investment banking. Today's topic is all about indexing. It comes back to a paper that Jeff wrote about why we might invest passively or why we might not invest passively. And it's got a couple of really good reasons why we might choose to move away from a passive index and invest in a more active fashion. So do you want to take us through those, Jeff?
Yeah, sure, Tim. I'll just give a brief summary of reasons why you might not actually choose to go with the passive index to start with. And basically, the idea is there's five reasons why you do it. The first one of those is just simply because there is no index available that you can replicate. So that's somewhat trivial, but worth mentioning because there are some asset classes in which there isn't an index, private equity, perhaps hedge funds and so on. Then the second two reasons really fall into a group which says maybe you don't want to own the index in the first place. Owning a passive cap-weighted index may not be the way to go. And that second and third reasons are the following. You know, one is that maybe the index doesn't meet your objectives. It's not actually the thing that you want to hold. You want to hold something that's different to the index. And the third reason why you would not is that maybe you think the index itself is an inefficient investment, that it's not actually the best way to get access to the asset class. Moving on to the fourth and fifth reason, they both fit under the same banner of I believe that I can outperform the index. This, of course, is where the debate about active versus passive currently sits, on whether active management or an active approach can outperform the index. And I think you can break that into two parts. One is, do you have a reason to believe that active management as a whole can outperform the index? You know, if you invest with active investment managers, for instance, you think that cohort of investors can do better than the index? And again, that is exactly where the debate is focused, I think, has been focused to date on that particular question. And a subsidiary issue is whether you think you can access active investment managers that can beat the index. So you might actually say the average manager or the median manager can't outperform, but you could have a belief yourself that you can identify particular managers that can outperform. So you have a reason to go active for that. But anyway, that's a brief overview, and I'll shut up now, and we'll go into a bit of the discussion.
Thanks, Jeff. I think there's some great examples that Jeff has as part of that, which we might come back to later. But one for me was around the inefficient index. When you think about a bond index, the biggest issuers are the ones that are going to make up the largest part of the index. So as the Irish government was issuing more and more bonds through the last year, is that where you necessarily want to go? So that was a great example of an inefficient index. Putting aside for a second whether managers can beat the index or not, Michael, is there any other way in which a fund manager can help investors reach their objective?
Well, first of all, at a market level, the fund manager's job is to allocate capital efficiently. And it's often the fund manager who is the marginal buyer or seller setting the market price. When you go from along to an investor's perspective, I mean, for an investor, they can use a fund manager to access different strategies. So, I mean, first of all, growth strategies tend to outperform during bull markets or bubbles in periods where risk tends to be mispriced and leverage is increasing. And this is periods often characterized with lots of M&A activity, IPOs, hedge funds in the market. So growth strategies tend to be more associated with resource companies, which are more tied to the global economy. The other strategy, of course, you can access using an active manager as a value strategy. And value strategies tend to outperform in periods where markets revert towards historic means and economic and financial markets are actually contracting. So in general, value tends to be biased towards banks and industrial companies. These are more tied to interest rates and the domestic economy. A concentrated value manager is one that thinks about risk in a slightly different sense as well. So a concentrated value manager will think about risk in terms of the difference between the intrinsic value of a stock and the market price, and that's how they manage the risk of capital loss, rather than trying to diversify away stock-specific risk. So you see that value outperformed during the entire period from 1975 to 1996. Value funds such as mine actually did quite well post the tech boom, 2001-2002, post the LPT boom and bust, and through the collapse of a lot of highly leveraged companies such as Olco, MFS, Babcock & Brown and ABC Learning. It's important to remember, though, when you're looking at a particular style, such as value managers, they're not a homogeneous group. You've got to separate them. So they'll have different beta, different volatility. Some will perform better in down markets. Some will trade more. And, for example, my fund tends to perform better in down markets, tends to have a lower volatility and a lower beta, tends to trade less. And there's obviously greater tax effectiveness from doing that, and that's why we've been more suited to a retail investor.
Okay, thanks, Michael. I mean, one of the other objectives that you just touched on briefly is around tax. That we have different tax rules for superannuation investors, for pensioners, for individuals, and that's another reason why you have an objective there that may change the way you invest and may move you away from the index.
I might just add in there, I think one of the cleanest examples of where you may not want to hold the index and passively and go for something different is in fixed income, and particularly in a liability-driven situation. Because if your liability has a certain duration, you probably want to hold fixed income securities to at least hedge that liability and sort of match the duration. If you go and buy the fixed income index, you get the duration of the index, you actually get the credit exposure of the index, credit exposure being equity-like, mightn't they actually help you match liabilities and so on. So I think in that particular space, the difference between sort of holding just the passively weighted index and holding a group of assets to meet your objectives, I think, is clearest. More so than it probably is can be in the equity market, where Mike's been talking about do I want a value tilt or not in my portfolio. I mean, that's valid as well. But I think in fixed income, it's very clear that example.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. One for Andrew. So the work that your firm does relies on markets being inefficient. Can you explain the logic behind what you do?
Yep, definitely. I'm going to do without a microphone, so hopefully everyone can hear me down the back. Is that all right?
We need it for the recording, though.
I need it for the recording. Right, OK. I better hold the microphone then. Look, we think there's a number of advantages of passive investing. And certainly, if you think of passive investing, it's lower cost, it's typically lower turnover, very diversified. And what that can mean as well is that it's lower due diligence and monitoring costs. You're not worried if Michael is up here on the stage and what stocks he's going to be picking one day, or he might be moving to another firm the next day. But it is lower cost and it's lower due diligence. But if you think about what Jeff was talking about, he was talking about one way of passively managing funds, and that was cap weighting. Now, how many people here think the market is perfectly efficient? Well, that's fantastic, because neither do we. And I'm dealing with a room full of actuaries, I'm guessing, so if there was ever someone that thought the market might be efficient, I might have seen them out there.
They could be just shy, Andrew.
Well, I'm sure they might, Jeff, definitely. I'll ask the question again. Does anyone that's shy think that the market is perfectly efficient? No one? Okay. How many people? Well, excellent point. How many people think the market is either a little bit or, inefficient. Everyone, there we go. Thank you. Hugh, I'm glad you put up your hand. Michael, definitely. Jeff, hey, okay, everyone.
A little bit inefficient, doesn't know I should put my hand up. It's heavily inefficient.
And actually, so do we. We think markets are inefficient. And therefore, if you're weighting by price and cap weighting, what's that going to mean for your portfolio? We're going to be overweight overvalued companies and underweight undervalued companies relative to some unknown fair value. And if prices mean revert, what that can mean over the long term is a negative return drag. Notice I don't talk about alpha, I talk about a negative return drag from cap weighting. So the question is, how do you remove that return drag and capture the benefits of index investing, lower turnover, lower cost, diversified, very replicable, but remove that return drag? One, the easiest way of doing that is equal weighting a portfolio. And that will give you, that will break that link between price and portfolio weight. But you'll also have a portfolio that's pretty hard to trade because you'll have equal amount in stock 500 as in stock 1. It won't necessarily be representative of the economic opportunity set that you're capturing, and the turnover tends to be a little bit higher. So what we do is weight according to the economic footprint of a company. It's sales, 5 years of past sales. It's cash flow, again, 5 years of past cash flow. It's dividends, 5 years of historic dividends, and it's actual book value. And we build an index that is looks and feels like the underlying economy rather than the market. And that breaks the link between price and portfolio weight. It captures those benefits of indexing and in the long run delivers a 2 to 3% excess return. In more inefficient markets, it has delivered historically through simulated performance up to 9%. In emerging market equities over the last 17 years, you had the cap-weighted index, GDP in emerging markets doubled from 17% to 31% of world GDP. They actually, PPP adjusted, account for 47% of world GDP. If most people here, how do you think you would have gone? Would over the last 17 years in emerging markets, double-digit returns? Yep, the two of us, okay. Well, actually, you delivered 4.5% if you were cap-weighted. You would have got 5.5% if you were in cash. If you broke that link between price and portfolio weight, you would have actually started to get an equity risk premium, and you got 13% from a dumb old index that's just rebalancing based on the economic footprint of a company. I might leave it there. So, yeah. Michael?
Yep. I just wanted to echo a couple of things that Andrew said. I mean, it's actually quite true that a lot of indexes are inefficiently constructed. So just starting with a few smaller ones, I mean, you can see the Australian REIT index is now made up of 30% Westfield. You go to New Zealand, you go to other smaller markets in Asia and Europe, and they're actually very highly volatile markets. But Andrew raised the point about international indices, and it's actually quite true that with US and Europe now around 60% of the MSCI and the smaller, higher growth Asian economies underrepresented, that's also a market where an equally weighted or a global GDP weighted portfolio will actually outperform. I just wanted to raise another point in terms of Australia itself. Now, this is a point that's often debated. Australia is arguably a narrow market with around about a third financials, a third resources, and a third non-bac industrials. It doesn't really show up in its volatility relative to the world index as such, but it does show up in the trading behaviour of some of the larger institutional fund managers. So, I mean, that's another question of whether we've got a deep and diversified enough market in Australia.
I might. Yes.
I'm going to chime in, and I'm going to try and put this debate we're having around the efficacy of the index in sort of where it's where the theoretical roots come from. And it's basically modern portfolio theory. I mean, essentially, the modern portfolio theory, the CAPM and the rest of it, says there's a market portfolio out there that's optimal and the right portfolio for everybody to hold because of separation. That is, basically, you're holding the tangent portfolio on the efficient frontier. And there's a couple of assumptions that go into that that people, I think, have basically put their brains on hold about. One is that everybody sees the same efficient frontier and the same tangent portfolio. That actually is a special case that breaks down as soon as you admit differences in objectives and situations in it. In other words, everybody doesn't see the same optimal portfolio. They might have different optimal portfolios. So liabilities, I mentioned before, is one way of breaking that nexus, but it goes as far as, you know, tax and a whole range of different sort of things can, you know, their background assets such as human capital, all these sort of things can break that nexus. The second assumption that goes into that is that the market's efficient, and this is the second group we're talking about. If market efficiency breaks down and you have noise in the market, you know, maybe there's a different weighting scheme that is actually more optimal. And I know Andrew was talking about the fundamental indices, but there's one class of that. But there's a whole range of indices that people are playing around with out there that seem to give better risk-reward characteristics in backtesting, at least, and in application than market cap weighting. So you've got the fundamental indices, minimum variance portfolios. You may have some of you may have heard, of course. And there's risk-efficient weighted portfolios. I missed them all.
There's maximum diversification. There is hybrid portfolios that look to produce a portfolio halfway between equal weighting and cap weighting. And our view is they all beat the cap-weighted index essentially for the same reason. If markets aren't perfectly efficient, then they're all breaking that link with price and portfolio weight. And then you look at, okay, what are some of the characteristics of these indices? They all have some form of a value loading, which Michael touched on, and to a lesser degree, a small cap loading as well. But people, what is that value or small cap loading relative to? And I think this is an important point. A market cap portfolio is growth orientated and momentum chasing by definition. Higher growth companies will have a higher weight in that portfolio. So as soon as you break that link with price and portfolio weight, then you're going to have a value tilt. And people look at the pharma and French factors and think that they're that is a perfectly achievable, very easy to achieve a pharma French alpha. Well, they're a long short portfolio that's actually not that easily tradable. And so I think some of these alternative indices do a very good job of capturing the equity risk premium. And it should be emphasised that they're all long-term strategies. I could give a plug for our own indices, but I'll refrain at this point. But important things to take into point is some of those things like turnover, transaction costs, and some of those areas, which are hidden costs, which people don't always consider and think about when they're doing their portfolio construction, and can have a meaningful impact on returns.
I would say that, possibly to close off in this area, is that your cap weighting is your natural starting position because it is the lowest cost way of investing. You don't have it naturally rebalances and so on. But my feeling is people just think that's it. That's the default. That's the natural. You know, they don't think beyond that, whether in fact a different weighting system will be more efficient or a different weighting system would actually meet their objectives better. So that's why I think is the.
Pick up on a point there because this natural rebalancing. Well, Jeff, why would an investor want the most amount of money in the most expensive stock or sector at the market right at the peak of the market? I think that's one of the, drawbacks of market cap indexing is that there is no rebalancing back to a sensible anchor. And that's realistically where our portfolio, which we rebalance quarterly, makes, you know, quite a bit of its excess return. We're buying the unloved, the loathed, and contra-trading against a cap-weighted sort of index.
I guess one other type of style index that hasn't been discussed is also quality, because during some certain periods where rebalancing would be most likely to occur, you have a lot of leverage in the system. We actually use a style index of our own as part of our process in the early stage to screen our index, which is value factors such as price to earnings and things like Andrew's already talked about, but also quality in terms of balance sheet strength, which tend to be independent.
Okay. Right. Well, that we might move on to the next leg of Jeff's framework, which was if we believe markets are inefficient, then what about active management? So we've heard a lot of publicity around active management doesn't work. Perhaps you'd like to address that, Jeff?
Yeah. I'd just say, I'm going to start up with a point that really sort of annoys me a bit, that I hear everybody says active management doesn't outperform. I want to qualify that. Active management doesn't outperform if you look at US mutual funds, the most efficient market in the world with lots of competition. I would actually expect that. And yes, they don't cover their costs. Why it gets up my nose is because if you look at the Australian data, that is not actually true. In Australia, you know, if you took the Mercer Performance Analytics, I think the outperformance of active Australian equity managers is north of 100 basis points per annum. There's going to be some survivorship bias and other sort of biases in that database, so it's not going to be accurate. But that's more than enough to sort of cover the fees that an institutional investor will pay. Maybe not a private investor. So immediately you've got to, at least looking at the median manager, you might say, well, maybe, paying for active management does work in the Australian market. Why have we got this perception? If you went to the small cap area, the same database, and again, it could have biases in it, but the numbers are astounding. They're 500 basis points per annum plus. Really, they are. Hey, have a look at them. They're a lot. So I think one of the main things to recognise is the ability of active management to outperform is not something you can make a blanket statement about. It is contingent on the market and the circumstances that you're dealing with and the players in the market and whether the group of investors, that is active managers usually, has a comparative advantage within that market. And it also gets back to the efficiency of the index. Sometimes the index is a slow rabbit that can be easy to beat. And I suspect that's part of the reason why the small cap managers outperform so much. So I just sort of like to open with that comment, and I'll let sort of the more active manager people sort of talk about how they do it. But
yeah, given Michael works for an active manager, we might get your thoughts on why Australian active managers have outperformed.
Sure. Well, I might just, I guess we can talk about different markets favouring different styles and the information advantage of being a fund manager, but I might just focus on the small caps given the magnitude of outperformance. So, I mean, small caps, the small cap environment offers a greater opportunity set for stock selection. There's a lot of under-researched or neglected stocks. At the same time, a lot of stocks in the small ords have very undesirable characteristics, such as they're making losses, they're not earning positive earnings, and they have cash flows, often in some cases, they have cash flows insufficient to make their interest payments on their debt. So, for instance, you could actually, on this basis, you could screen out perhaps a third of the small industrials and perhaps even up to two-thirds of the small resources, which that's almost half the small odds that you might actually cross out as uninvestable in the first instance. Another interesting point is just looking at the domestic investors in the Australian small caps versus the overseas investors. So when US investors invest domestically, they'll put money in large caps as well as complementing that with small cap exposures. When they come to Australia to diversify in a global portfolio, they focus on the large caps. And I don't know if this is intentional, but you think that small caps being more correlated with the domestic economy and with domestic interest rates would actually provide stronger diversification benefits.
I'd agree with both Michael and Jeff, And our starting point is that markets, you know, aren't perfectly efficient. And therefore, you know, that should lead itself to some active managers doing quite well. And, you know, certainly they do. I guess the issue there is that, you know, getting access, well, they can be expensive. I know personally I'm quite frugal, so I sort of, you know, what appeals to me is the costs of our funds relative to a sort of typical active manager, and also, you know, the lower turnover nature, which versus the average, and again I'm using this, average active manager is significantly sort of lower. I guess you touched on, Tim, you touched on, and certainly Jeff touched on fixed income markets, where I'd actually say, to Jeff's point there, if you go back a couple of years before the GFC, if you looked at index bond management there, it actually was probably top quartile performer. Yet 98% of probably money invested is money invested in active management within bonds, because people are concerned about the risk-reward trade-off within that part of the market, and certainly how the cap-weighted index bonds are constructed. Putting more money in the most indebted country or company doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And again, you can break the link between price and portfolio weight there. But people have paid what I see as effectively an insurance premium for some of the issues that are involved around the nature of cap-weighted indices within the bond market.
Well, there are other problems with the bond index. Did you have any thoughts on that, Jeff?
Well, I think we raised the biggest one. Mm. It is harder to replicate. I'm not sure this is true, but somebody told me once that, you know, through the stratification process, that there's a natural tendency if you go for... because you don't actually never buy the index, you buy a passive manager, but the passive manager naturally underperforms through the stratification process. I will say, though, that the data on fixed income managers, where you would expect them to outperform an index that should be relatively easy to beat, isn't as good as, say, Australian equity managers. So I think that's the other thing to bear in mind as well. But the main problem is that it's not necessarily efficient, because it's just the people who happen to issue are in the index. And if they issue more, they're a bigger weight and they may not be the people you want to hold. I heard somebody call that the bums problem once. You know, you just buy your index is full of a bunch of bums. You don't want to hold them.
So if we think we can, we think some managers can outperform, the next challenge, of course, is choosing the managers that we think are going to outperform. So, Mike, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, just initial observation is that there's been a lot of research into the life cycle of boutiques. So fund managers early in their life cycle will tend to outperform because they have more capacity, less funds under management, and they have lower market impact. But I think Jeff can probably contribute a bit more on this topic from his research?
Well, from my research, one thing that one missing part of this puzzle, by the way, is manager selection and the puzzle in terms of the availability of data is sort of management selection and the portfolio management function around active management. You know, how do you select active managers and how do you put them together when you're forming multi-manager portfolios, which is what the biggest, you know, super and pension funds do. And more recently, a database has started to become available in this, a global database, and some research is coming out of it, you know, put together by people in Canada. I forget the name of the group now, but, you know, tied up with the Reitman Pension Fund sort of people and so on. And what that's actually looked at US defined benefit funds and found that they outperform after costs about 170 basis points per annum. Now, this is interesting because they're actually investing in a group of managers we know that probably underperform after costs. And what that's telling you is there's something, at least in that group, that yet comes to light, but there's something in the manager selection and portfolio construction facility that is adding to returns there. And it could be something as simple as that when you look at the universe of managers, we know that from the academic data there's poor performing managers seem to survive. The private investor continues to to keep their money in them. They seem to put their brains in hold and not take it out. And they're going to be part of the underperformance. But a monitored portfolio, as soon as the key portfolio manager leaves, so does the funds. You're out of it. You know, you take your loss on that one and move on to the next best manager. So I think the jury is still out on whether how much value can be created from selecting managers and putting together a portfolio. But you know, I think that's sort of it's hopeful that, you know, maybe there is value to be added there.
Look, on that point, as I suppose if you see a lot of retail investors that are sort of agnostic to where they're investing, then surely cost must matter to that client base, and I guess be in the probably the, you know, the perceived lowest risk from sort of introducing sort of people leaving or that could be detrimental to their returns. But I'd also add, and you know, ultimately, if you're thinking about broader portfolios and really objectives, which is the name of the game at the end of the day, and you know, to achieve you know, CPI plus X, or to achieve, you know, a certain income level in retirement, you know, that's got to be our focus, really, as you know, from a total portfolio point of view, and obviously, you know, equities, bonds, property, etc., is just one tool of getting there. I think managing that asset allocation mix is going to be the most important determinant of how you're going to get there. Because buy an asset when that's expensive, you're going to hold it for the very long term. Buy it when it's cheap, and you mightn't be holding it for so long. So, you know, this notion that equities always outperform bonds isn't always right. It depends on the pricing level of any asset class and when you sort of buy it. Slightly off topic, but I think it's relevant given that, you know, benchmarks are one thing, but objectives really are what matters. And I think we pay probably too much attention to the detail. Like if you fly to Melbourne, and this isn't my analogy, but I'll use it. If you fly to Melbourne, you want to know what time you get there. You know, you won't worry about what the what sort of the fabric of the seat is, what the television station is going to be playing, whether it's you know, a 330 or a, you know, 767 or an A380. You sort of, you know, you really want to get there and get there reliably. I think in funds management sometimes we tend to lose sight of our objectives, but thinking about, you know, too much at the granular level, rather than focusing on our objectives and how best to get there.
Look, I absolutely agree with Andrew's philosophy there. And, you know, capital preservation and consistency of distributed income are clearly some of the fundamental objectives of the ultimate retail investor. I just wanted to pick up a couple of points from what Jeff said about US pension funds, just from my experience in the Australian industry. So first of all, this you know, the persistency we observe in the lower quartile of fund managers, why might that exist? And I have a couple of ideas. One of which is the cyclicality of capacity in the industry. So, and the second is the difficulty in actually determining that a manager has been unlucky versus actually below par on a track record less than 10 years. I just wanted to mention one other thing, which was that we do have a lot of examples in Australia of blending ending up in diversification, you know, large multi-managers who diversify away all of the outperformance that they achieve from their individual managers after fees.
All right. What we might do now is open up to the audience for any questions of the panellists. Yeah, come up to the microphone. Yeah, if you want to come up to the microphone.
Kerry Hellenius. Just I can't quite get the distinction between active index managing and an active manager who has just a detailed process in place. Is there any real difference there? And are the costs involved in an active index, aren't they? Shouldn't they be fairly similar to a manager that's just active with a process?
First of all, we wouldn't... I guess it's firstly a question about indexing. And if your frame of reference is cap weighting, then we'd say, OK, well, our index might be active. But if your frame of reference is the economy, then we'd say, well, we're very passive next to that economy. We're not making any active decisions. All we are is ranking stocks based on their economic footprint. So we don't call ourselves an active index per se, but the outcomes are certainly competitive with some of the better active managers. In terms of the costs, our costs are much more comparable to index managers at a retail sort of level rather than active managers from that perspective. So I think it comes down to, your frame of reference of whether we are, that's a debate about fundamental indexing. Is it active management in disguise? Is it a value index in disguise? And there's certainly been a lot of academic argument about that. I mean, our point of view would be that, we're not saying that those measures are a better measure of fair value. We're not making judgments on company management. And when you look at an index, is it replicable, is it transparent, and is it repeatable? It ticks all those boxes. But it's not going to deliver you a market cap return.
Okay. And can I just ask the second part to that question? And it's just really around the index. Like, if you've established an index, is one of the objectives to try and beat the index, or...?
One of our objectives is... I guess our starting point is thinking that a market cap index isn't going to deliver you the best long-term return. So, yeah, it is. We did construct it to beat a market cap index, 100% right, because we didn't think that was constructed efficiently. We actually call it an efficient index for inefficient markets.
I'd like to say that I think one of the problems with the active versus passive debate is it's viewed as a dichotomy rather than a spectrum. That right down one end, you've got the most passive is market cap weighting to the extent it rebalances automatically. You don't have to trade it, right? And then next to that is probably enhanced index, where you're actually trying to provide, say, liquidity facilities in the market and make a little bit of additional return. And then you're going to sort of other forms of indexing, which have implicit within, you could argue they have a strategy or they're just a better weighting system. And then you keep on going through the spectrum till you get out to active managers, long only, which are a confluence of alpha and beta. And then if you went to a pure hedge fund, what you've got there is just pure skill, pure active attempt to secure alpha. So I think if you view it as a spectrum, it frees you up and you think, okay, well, where do I need to be in the spectrum? Where are my objectives? What degree of activeness do I want, really?
Other questions?
I think that's a really important question to have been raised, because there are a lot of overlaps in terms of process, and we do start with a ranking screen ourselves. It's just we believe we can add a lot more value with putting up bottom-up research to actually filter further and concentrate further, and that's the way, I guess that's the spectrum in terms of active management.
Hi, Melinda House from the Institute of Actuaries. In the plenary session this morning, Hazel McNeilage from QIC made some fairly provocative comments, and she basically said that she thought that super funds were being a little bit Me Too in the way they were investing their money. She thought that the focus on fees meant that Australia was going too much towards index type portfolios at the expense of innovation. And she also said that compared to overseas, we're less innovative than we were a number of years ago before she went overseas. So I'd just like to get the panel's reaction to those deliberately provocative comments, I think she said they were.
Well, I think it's a tough environment at the moment for being active and innovative. Obviously, there's been a knee-jerk reaction to a very tough period in markets following what was probably one of the strongest bull runs since the 87 crash, and throw in some regulatory changes to push down fees, and it is a tough environment to be innovative unless that innovation is around cutting costs.
I recall listening to Hazel and nodding my head just about everything she said. And in particular, if I recall correctly, one of the problems was that we put our, I think she's essentially saying you put your brains on hold when you just index and we just go there and go to the cheapest solution. I recall I mentioned that in Australia, active management has outperformed. It's not automatic that index is the best solution, but we're assuming that low cost is best. That's wrong. And I also recall her mentioning that objective should be put central, which I think is... I think that's probably the key message to take on board in this context.
Great question, Melinda. But I'd add to that also that, if Cooper didn't just say... He didn't say the lowest fees. He said maximise the after-tax objectives of a fund. And I think that goes back to that point of what I was saying. There's been too much focus at a granular level of... worrying about which managers to have, whereas, rather than focusing on, the asset allocation decision, which is really what's going to drive long-term returns, given that that's the driver. So more focus at the CPI plus X or whatever the objective of the fund is, managing to those objectives. If that means that, that changes the asset mix through time, then, so it should. I mean, because asset allocation is difficult and because you can be wrong for a long time, we've found that, there's not many people that openly sort of profess to being big asset allocators. We don't really in our market have people like Jeremy Grantham. We don't have people challenging status quo, the James Montiers, the Rob Arnotts. We haven't sort of produced, someone with that big sort of asset allocation views that's going to challenge, conventional thinking. And I'd say that, therein does lie the challenge of the industry. And a big part of that is, I think, peer group. Peer groups as across the industry. And I think as well, the biggest issue for superannuation funds, I don't think it's a retail versus industry fund debate anymore. I think people are focusing on self-managed super funds and the growing part of that market segment, because by far that's the biggest growth of our superannuation industry, and why people going there for control, I think, and some of those things. And so we as an industry have to understand that.
I'm going to question that notion that asset allocation is dead. I think it's made a big comeback. You've got every consultant in the country now has some sort of dynamic asset allocation service, as I understand it. Even my ex-employer, Russell, who was dead set, stick to your strategic asset allocation, has a strategic tilting group. So they shifted ground. I think Taos Watson does, and so on. So I think, and there's a big interest, as I understand it, in the major super funds to not stick to the strategic asset allocation. So I disagree with that. I think we don't have any of the likes of, Jeremy Grantham here. There's nobody there that I can identify, but we are, I think in Australia, rethinking the asset allocation process.
I'd actually agree with rethinking it. But if you looked at the diversified funds and stacked them up, you'd find 60% would be in equities plus or minus 5%. So maybe there is, some decisions there around that plus or minus 5%. And, DAA is the new TAA, and obviously SAA and DAA. But I don't think we've gone, we're on the path to redefining the objectives and to thinking about those objectives. But I don't think we're sort of there yet. And to be honest, in a world of choice, member investment choice, is that really encouraging long-term thinking, or is it encouraging herding? I would argue the latter, that it's encouraging herding, because if you're too far away from anyone, then you're going to be shot as a for doing that, because your performance will suffer. You're not going to get your DAA or SAA calls right. You're going to be wrong and alone for a certain period of time, and it requires patience, and it requires a long-term perspective, and from all areas of the fund, from the member to the investment committee to the consultant.
Can I just tweak this. I think there is a focus on asset allocation, but the problem is that peer risk is one of the key objective functions in which that is done. So there is a limit to how far people move away. So, again, that was a point that Hazel made, that we're too peer risk-focused, and I think that's constraining it where we go.
I think Mike had a...
Now we're on to asset allocation. I'd like to buy into the debate. Mike Barker. I think you're right. The difference between here and America is we really don't have any contrarian asset allocators. My sense is that the consultants that are offering strategic asset allocation or tactical asset allocation are just asking all the fund managers what they think, and they're following the consensus rather than actually doing anything contrarian. And Jeremy Grantham, of course, is the great contrarian manager, which leads me to a question. One of the things Jeremy Grantham has pointed out about the American market is that you have the profit cycle. You have profit margins going up and down, and you'd think when profit margins are high, the market would be selling on a low PE, and vice versa. And yet, if you look at the correlation, the higher the profit margin, the higher the PE. Profit margins go down, and the PE goes down. And so, it's actually a classic inefficiency. What I'm wondering is whether you've seen anything. Has any work been done on the Australian market on that? Is the same thing happen here, or do actual active managers look through the cycle and try and price on the basis of mean reversion of profit margins?
Well, when we look at profit margins, we obviously look at the sustainability of those profit margins, and also whether the business's performance is driven by leverage. And I think in the Australian context, you can ask the same question in terms of leverage. Are we at a point where I guess a lot of activity is occurring on the back of debt. Is that likely to mean revert? But yes, we do look across the market on that basis.
Yeah, I think there's, having looked at style in the Australian market, there is definitely a cohort of what you call deep value contrarian managers within the market, and there's matched on the other side is a big horde of momentum players. But IML, I think, fits into the contrarian camp.
Yeah.
The person who made the comments this morning, I thought I might chance my hand again. In terms of this question of dynamic asset allocation, I'm very pleased to see consultants starting to really offer this as a service. But I think one of the challenges we've got as investment managers is that investment management has become very, very specialised. Everybody has their little niche. And really, to do dynamic asset allocation well, it's really important to have a whole of fund framework. And deliberately, I think as an industry, we've kind of moved away from that. The things like the popularity of the boutique model, for example, deliberately move people into specialist niches and away from this whole notion of really focusing on the whole of fund. And I'd be interested in comments on that. As a second point, this idea that you need to be very peer risk aware, because otherwise you will potentially lose members who will be comparing returns. I think, in fact, a lot of funds find that members use an approach which I think has got a lot of benefit, which is basically benign neglect. That a lot of people aren't there comparing their returns on a kind of shorter term basis and making decisions based on that. And I would hope very much that again, we can educate members and give them the products that allow them to be comfortable on a longer-term basis with their strategies without making those shorter-term comparisons and acting on them, which, again, then reinforces this potential peer risk pressure.
Thank you. I'm going to suggest that actually Tim answers this because he has to tell the story of the clients at Russell, doesn't
yeah,
it? Do
yeah,
you?
I'm out in front of the clients and the members, so that's my role in some of this. Look, what Hazel says is right when we talk about peers, that there's probably 80% of the population that sits in a default somewhere and isn't actively managing things and making choices. However, the other 20-odd percent or whatever it actually happens to be is very vocal. And that's what drives behaviour. When, as an individual, you have to go and front up in front of a policy committee meeting or a trustee board and have people go, well, why is this the way it is? I don't understand why you didn't get out of the equity market just before it crashed. And you have to explain that. Then that's where, you know, being with the peers becomes somewhat comfortable. So, look, you're right, but the vocal minority is probably what's driving behaviour, as it does in a lot of other cases. Panellists?
I might just pipe up and defend the specialised boutiques a little bit if I can. okay, I take your point in terms of whole of fund, but there's actually a lot you can do in terms of matching objectives at the individual fund level. But the thing you've got to bear in mind is that the repeatability and credibility of that process won't be clear until you've got a manager that's been around through a few cycles and you can really tell how it is they manage money, what their tax consequences are, etc. And I think a lot of those things like tax can actually be managed at the fund manager level in terms of just the way that you manage your portfolio. And the danger I see is that in combining at a whole of fund level, potentially you get a duplication and some sort of diluting of some of these competitive advantage you might have at the fund manager level. I might leave it to the other guys to contribute if you've got anything else there.
I guess the only other thing that I would add is, I think that potentially managers will come up with more products that are, single managers, aiming to deliver just focused on objectives of CPI plus something. And so, instead of saying we'll be between X and X of an asset allocation, they'll say, no, we'll get you this objective, and managing that. So what does that mean? It means if credit is three standard deviations cheap, then they may have 80% of your portfolio invested in credit and 10% in, cash. And or they might have at 6.5% if they're able to get term deposit rates, that, which is, 200 over inflation at the moment, they might have 50% of your portfolio if they can get access to that at this point of time. So I agree, Hazel, maybe there is a place in the market for that. It's probably not going to be at the larger fund level, because they're going to be they're putting resources into making those sorts of decisions themselves. I think internally you're seeing more focus on the asset allocation calls. But if you look at the industry, if any funds or consultants, there's 50 people working in fund manager research and there's two people working in capital asset markets. So it's not, whilst there may be resource going into that level, it's a little bit inverse. And I've got, it's not in my best interest. I haven't got an asset allocation product that I'm flogging, but, I just think it's a little bit, it's sometimes strange when you think about it.
Yeah, I just agree with that, and the resource the resourcing in this area isn't as large, and the real reason is the way the fee structures are in the industry. A typical super fund pays lots of money to beat the index in active management or whatever, and yet the amount of resources often committed into things like asset allocation, including asset consultants, which are paid by fees, not percentage of funds under management, is under-resourced. So probably the whole of fund really does matter, but it's not actually where the big dollars are put into getting the best result or the big focus. So, and it all comes from the remuneration structures in the industry.
We have time for one last question, if anyone has one. No. Well, I have one final wrap-up for the for the panel. So after all that discussion, is a passive index the natural default? And if so, which index? You want to start, Andrew?
Thanks for the leading question there. I would say, look, one thing that I should have made clear is that, look, a market cap index does measure the market return. I guess we don't think it gives you the best long-term investment outcome. And that would be, you know, our beliefs. And so we think that you can still manage money passively, just not cap weighting.
I think you start at the market cap weighted index and you ask yourself two questions. One, is the index the thing I want to hold as my default? And secondly, do I think I have the capability to do better than the index because either active managers as a group have some comparative advantage or I think I can pick good managers? And if you can't answer any of those questions in the positive, then you go to the passive.
I agree that the index is a great way to benchmark your expectations in the market. However, I think it's important to start with your objectives and match your assets to those objectives carefully. It's interesting that not all indices are representative of the opportunity sets in the market. Some are not fit for purpose. Some are poorly constructed. Some have undesirable constituents and sectoral skews. So, I mean, it's sometimes the case that the index is a lazier option, which is not necessarily lower risk than active approaches, and not necessarily matched to the objectives as the ultimate retail investor.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Now, I need to remind you all to fill out your feedback forms and leave them outside, but can you please thank our panellists in the normal way?